Every year, people die from being squeezed or trampled by other people. What causes these human stampedes, and how do we prevent them? I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. You're at a football game with some friends. There's standing room only. You got there fairly early, so you're somewhere near the middle of the crowd. At first, it's not much different from any other big event. As more people arrive, it gets crowded. For a while, you're annoyed that people keep filling in the space in front of you. You were there first. But soon it doesn't matter, because every space around you is now full. You can feel a slight but perceptible force pushing you into the person in front of you. Then the calls from the front start. Move back. We're squished against the fence. You dig your feet into the ground to try and resist the forward motion, but it's too strong, and you have no leverage. You're packed in on all sides, so your feet can do nothing but keep you standing. Your friends are gone now. If you're not tall, you can't see anything but heads and shoulders. You're no longer in control of your fate. Panic starts to set in. Not just for you, for everyone. You can hear it in their voices. Let me out. Move back. Someone help me. I can't breathe. The screaming starts. People aren't just scared, they're in agony. Breathing has become a zero-sum game. You try to use your arms to protect your lungs, but no matter how hard you push, they stay pinned to your sides. Every now and then a wave surges through the crowd, blasting the air out of you as you slam into the person in front of you. A few lucky ones around you are climbing, but as they get above the crowd, others subsume. The air is hot and wet like a sauna, so the few breaths you manage to take still feel suffocating. You look at the man next to you. His skin is chalk white, and his lips are blue. Now you know for sure. You're dying. The only way out is up, but going up involves a 7-foot climb up a fence, the last foot projecting back at you. These fences were specifically designed to prevent people from getting over or through them. Despite the enormous pressure that's building up around you, it's the human bodies that are bending, not the steel. Someone small manages to scramble onto your shoulders. A kid. You hold him up long enough for someone on the fence to grab him, but then your knees buckle. You simply don't have the strength to stay standing. The crowd jostles around you. Someone steps on you. Several people step on you or kick you, stumbling over your body. The little space you took up has now been completely filled. A solid mass of human weight pins you to the ground. You already took your last breath a long time ago. Too long ago. You pass out. In a minute, you've suffered irreparable brain damage. In 5 minutes, you're dead. This describes the experience of 94 people who died in Sheffield on the 15th of April, 1989. Despite the characterization of this event and others like it as stampedes, panic is rarely a contributing factor to the deaths. Crowds that suffer mass casualties, like the Liverpool fans who died in the Hillsborough disaster, are notable for their calm in the face of imminent death. Perhaps the most frightening thing about crushing incidents is how little control the people experiencing them have to stop it. Once you realize a crush is coming and that you're in it, there's little you can do to change your outcome. Crush victims quickly find themselves carried along by the flow of people. A recent review of human stampede literature published in Pre-Hospital and Disaster Medicine describes how stampedes happen in clinical but still quite vivid terms. Quote, in normal situations, the crowd moves in a free or laminar flow. When density increases, the flow changes to stop-and-go waves. This can lead to loss of movement control by the crowd, and individuals are pushed randomly, crowd turbulence. When a person loses balance and stumbles, or is pushed down, the people around them fall due to the sudden forces imbalance. To avoid falling, trampling, which is the act of standing or walking on someone else, may occur. People at the bottom of the crowd eventually die of traumatic asphyxia. Injury from trampling is not the main cause of death. It's actually the pressure that builds up in the crowd that kills, and often kills people while they're still standing. They only fall when the crowd disperses, having been dead for a long time. In up to 95% of cases, victims have at least one of these three signs. One, conjunctival petechia, which is burst blood vessels in the eye or eyelid, facial petechia, which is burst blood vessels in the face, and congestion of the face and neck caused by a back pressure of the venous flow. So this indicates that victims become so compressed that blood can't drain back down from their heads, causing the blood vessels to burst in their face and eyes from the pressure. Oxygenated blood, if any is available in their body, can't reach the brain because the unoxygenated blood is still in there. All three of these signs point to the same cause of death, which is traumatic asphyxia. Asphyxia is oxygen deprivation. In this case, it's the brain that's being deprived of oxygen. It takes less than 5 minutes to die this way. As such, throughout these series, I prefer the term human crush to stampede. Stampede conjures visions of people running around trampling on others. In fact, crushes are caused by people exceeding a safe local density. Rarely are people able to get anywhere close to running. They quickly lose all agency over their body, and the trampling that occurs is an effort to keep themselves from falling down. So the term stampede really creates the wrong image. This is not to say that crowd rushing doesn't contribute to the tragedies. Many deadly crushes happen when a crowd presses in towards something of interest or is fleeing from something that they fear or that can hurt them. But the key detail is that this isn't an every man for himself pile on of panicked sheep. To quote an authority on crowd safety research, Dr. G.K. Stills, people don't die because they panic. They panic because they're dying. The flow of people that creates the pressure that kills can only be managed on a macro scale. The individual decisions of people in the crush might contribute to whether an individual lives or dies, but has little impact on the overall magnitude of the disaster and the overall death. Many of the deadliest stampedes were also the deadliest fires. As such, many of the fire safety measures that were enacted over the 20th century were also human stampede countermeasures. Virtually every commercial building and workplace has a maximum occupancy determined by the local fire code to prevent the crushes that happen at evacuation bottlenecks. Bottlenecks at exits can quickly block an exit entirely, dooming the people who are still trying to use that exit. The majority of deaths in large-scale fire disasters are caused by exits being blocked by crushes. As recently as 2003, 100 people died in a nightclub fire trying to use a single exit when another was available. Music venues are especially susceptible because crushes can be very localized events. Even in large outdoor festival-style events, small-scale crushes can happen when there's a surge in local traffic, like when a crowd pushes towards a stage. In most cases, the victims of compression can be saved if treated quickly. If crush victims get rapid first aid and are triaged quickly, many lives can be saved. Unfortunately, many of the systemic failures that lead to crushes also lead to a slow and haphazard response. And we saw that most recently and viscerally with the Travis Scott Astroworld disaster. Ultimately, the best remedy for these events is planning the space correctly and reacting quickly to developing problems. Every large venue needs to train staff in crush procedures, just like any other disaster that can occur. So let's take a closer look at some of the deadliest and most memorable stampedes and crushes in human history to see what they share and how we can avoid them. The Royal Wedding. While it appears that most crushes have happened in the 20th and 21st centuries, there were probably many crushes in history that went unremarked upon in chronicles or downplayed by rulers. One of the earliest and possibly deadliest crushes slips under the radar and is rarely mentioned in connection with this famous monarch. On May 30th, 1770, Parisians crowded the streets to watch a fireworks display around 9 p.m. The French aristocracy had grown accustomed, even bored, of fireworks as Marie Antoinette made her way across the country to meet her new husband, being greeted lavishly at each step. She'd already married the French crown prince, remotely in Austria, her brother stood in for the groom, and the tour was designed to win support for this controversial and irrevocable decision. Fireworks were a new invention, and they were used extravagantly to impress nobility and commoner alike. In Paris, the fireworks were launched from the Temple of Hymen, the god of marital love, built to honor this marriage. They'd hired the Ruggieri brothers, the foremost pyrotechnic experts of their day. The family had earned the patronage of King Louis XV and were appointed royal artificers. The family would go on to invent many of the techniques of modern fireworks shows today, including moving effects, unique shapes, and different colors, and the company still exists today. Many pyrotechnic displays were intricately planned, including several firework-spewing dolphins, to honor the title given to the crown prince of France, the Dauphin, which means dolphin. The Dauphin of France, the soon-to-be Louis XVI, needed this night to be a success. In A History of Paris, written over a century later, Henry Sutherland describes how the wind blew partially exploded fireworks off the scaffolding, burning and terrifying the crowd. Then the stampede began. Quote, "There was in the first place a general rush towards the Rue Royale, far too narrow to receive such an invasion. And in the crush, numbers of women fainted, fell, and were trampled to death. To make matters worse, the stream of persons pressing into the Rue Royale was met by a counterstream, advancing in ignorance of what had taken place to the Place de la Concorde. Even these, who were not in imminent peril, were now affected by the panic, which soon became universal. In the midst of shrieks and groans, some desperate men drew their swords and endeavored to cut themselves a passage through the dense mass by which they were surrounded." So I guess we can at least be thankful that nowadays a lot of people aren't swinging swords in crushes. We can see in this early example that it was the fluid dynamics of a large crowd pressing into a small street, as well as a counterflow, that caused the crush, once the danger of being exploded by fireworks became imminent to the crowd. A crowd always needs ways to evacuate an area quickly, even if it's a large outdoor area. Estimates on the death toll vary. A guide published in 1839 describes 3,000 mortally injured, which is substantially higher than the official estimate, which is only 133. This was in the early days of journalism, which was developing in Paris, mostly through the publication of what today we'd call think pieces or essays, rather than objective fact reporting. It was relatively easy for a powerful ruler to simply bury embarrassing incidents like this, particularly if none of the victims were notable. We can only assume how many similar situations preceded this one. It was an inauspicious start to the marriage, and a cloud that Louis would carry into his reign. The dead were buried in a mass grave in Paris at the Madeleine Cemetery. 23 years later, the decapitated bodies of the married couple were unceremoniously dumped on the pile. When the monarchy was restored after Napoleon's fall, the royal bodies were identified with scant evidence. Marie Antoinette was identified by her jaw based on the opinion of someone who had seen her 30 years earlier. But the two bodies were removed to the Basilica of Saint-Denis. The victims of their wedding remained in the cemetery until 1844, when they were removed to the catacombs, where they remain today. If you've heard earlier episodes of this podcast, you may be thinking, that was awfully short. I'm trying out a new format to make this podcast more approachable for new listeners by putting out shorter episodes every week. I'm still writing and recording these in the same way. I'm just cutting them into four episodes rather than having a hour-long monthly episode. If you want to hear the full hour at the beginning of each month, they're available on Patreon. Support there allows me to create in-depth, well-researched episodes like this one. If you enjoyed it, please consider signing up.